Mine's on.
It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
This is Dan from Greymaker.
This is Sasha the Lot.
Howdy, folks. We're the Bitter Weed Drawn.
This is Zach from Black Breath.
Hi, this is Artie from Broken Bones.
Hello, Vancouver. This is Carolyn Mark.
I'm Water Crime Guide.
This is Dan Mangan.
Hey, this is David Pepke from Denmark.
This is Dylan Osick from Slingshot.
Hi, this is Dick Valentine from Electric City.
Hi, everybody. This is Fred Penner on the Radio Waves.
This is Fred Schneider.
This is Colin from GBH.
Hi, this is the Gearing Up Inventors.
Hi, this is Ben Ditto from The Gossip.
Hi, this is Brian from Hellshock.
This is Scruffmouth the Scribe.
I'm Shani from Inepsy.
This is Sab Gray from Iron Cross.
Hey, we're J plus J plus J.
This is Jack Mercer from Jack Mercer and the Whiskey Bandits.
It's James Wood, half of Mega Bear.
This is Jeron Paxton, American musicianer.
This is Swami Bill and the Shameless Weed Hounds from New Orleans, Louisiana, east of the Mississippi.
Hi, this is John Boutte from New Orleans, Louisiana.
This is Jesse Laborde.
I'm Peter Mansbridge.
Hi, this is Ron McLean of Hockey / Movie Night in Canada.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, also on the web, CITR.ca, in UBC, University of British Columbia, in Vancouver, Canada. Have our people contact your people, won't you?
Saturday, February 11th, George Bear presents Bob Marley's birthday bash at the Grandview Legion Hall on Commercial Drive. Come enjoy Jamaican food and refreshments and listen to the East Van All-Stars live. Get your tickets at Zulu Records, High Life Records, and Butter King.
My little hands numb, they're numb.
legs, they crawl straight through me.
Hey, this is Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. We are broadcasting live from the traditional ancestral and unceded territory of the Hunkamina-speaking Musqueam people. My name is Josh. I'm here with Dora in the studio today. Dora's going to tell us a little story. Dora, introduce yourselves for the listeners.
Hi, listeners. I'm Dora. For those of you who don't know me, just like come to the station at any time. I'm probably going to be here. I do a lot of stuff.
That's it.
Fingers in all the pots. So I will just like go into my story.
Just do it.
This story is, like, very strange. It happened to me just this weekend. I guess this week it was the wee hours of Monday morning. I was coming home from the Red Gate show with Gesture, which we just listened to, and they just broke up. It was, like, their last show.
Thanks for that. Yeah, that last track was Gesture. It was called Embedded Rings, Urban Dirt. It was off their self-titled EP. Thank you so much for that, Dora.
No worries. I love them. I know the members of the band, and I always got very nervous around them because I love Gesture a little bit. I think it's amazing. I'm very sad they're broken up, but they broke up. Green Wine had their last performance, and the Pale Red played, which like was actually very full circle for me because I just did a feature on them, and I did the whole feature in Discorder about like how I'd never met them and never seen them.
Oh,
so
great.
It was like cool that like the day before it got like published, I like actually got to meet them and like just complete that.
Pick up the new copy of Discorder.
Oh, yeah. Also, shameless plug. Yeah. I'm just, like, really hitting all the points. But that was a really fun show. I kind of stumble home. It was 2 or 3 in the morning. And I live in it's, like, technically a street, but it's, like, an alley, like, right behind or just east of Main. And I'm at 28th. So I just got off the 3rd at 28th, and I kind of walk in, and I turn on to 28th and, like, almost get to Watson, and there is a huge line of police cars.
Oh, no.
And I, like, drunk Dora is like, be cool. Like, keep it together. Like, you are feeling great. No. This is actually quite a sad story.
I'm already laughing, but yeah,
cool. But I walk by, and there's this guy who's obviously super drunk, like, being handcuffed. Like, no crime has been committed here. Like, let's all chill out, guys. And I was like, okay. And I live on the, like, eastmost side of the alley. Mm-hmm. So I kind of stayed on that side and just went into my house and whatever. And I just looked out the window and kind of surveilled everything. And I saw the south side of it, which had all the police cars. But I missed the north side of it, which had a bunch of ambulances. Mm. And there was a guy in the parking lot, like right behind the restaurant that's across from my house, who was just like on the ground. And I was like, oh no, what's going on? So I kind of just like noted that, and then went about like getting ready for bed. Did my routine, got to my bed, which kind of faces out the alley. I have a window that faces out mm-hmm. the alley, and I looked out, and they had removed the person from the ground and put him on a gurney and covered him with a sheet.
Oh,
and
wow.
They were pushing him into the ambulances. And that's my story.
He was passed.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I tried to Google it the next day and nothing came up.
No idea.
Yeah. So it's so weird. Don't know what happened.
Do you think it's connected to anything that was happening on that street? What's around on 28th? It was like past when the bars had closed.
Yeah. Nothing's happening at 28th. Like, that's also the thing. Like, where you were at Simply's, like, maybe you, like, went to East is East and got, like, super wrecked. Like, I don't know what it could have been. Because also, it was, like, just behind a restaurant. Like, it wasn't even, like, I can imagine that kind of, there's, like, some altercation happening, like, at the front of a restaurant where there's high traffic. But, like, the parking lot was empty. It was just behind it.
Mm-hmm.
What happened?
Wow. That's pretty, how did you feel about that when you woke up in the morning?
I felt, well, kind of dirty because I had taken a picture and been like, something's going on outside my apartment and sent it, like snapped it to a bunch of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I woke up the next morning and I'd forgotten it had happened kind of until I checked my phone and I got a bunch of messages that were like, whoa, what happened? Like, what's going on? And I felt dirty, A, that I had watched, just kind of like watched this because it wasn't really my business. And then B, that I had shared it with a bunch of people. And then C, that I didn't have any answers, that I had just kind of been like, this happened. And I didn't kind of inquire, like try to check in with anything else.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a really weird encounter, especially because, yeah, photography's involved and that's always like kind of a weird experience. It kind of like rubbernecking in the same way that rubbernecking can feel kind of dirty.
Yeah.
That's odd. And I mean, it's not like you really had a responsibility to give answers though at the same time. But then it...
Yeah, so my sister said, I texted her and I was like, I made a mistake, like drunk Dorothy did this. And she was like, no one else, like you don't have to provide these.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you do. Yeah, that's a really tricky situation. I don't know. I guess like it's definitely not your responsibility, but at the same time, there's this thing where like when people, I don't know, when people die, when people get hurt, there's this kind of sense where like you need to do it justice to get the full story. I don't know. That's something I've been kind of thinking about recently.
Oh no, totally. I remember like the night of, I was like, I should go down and ask what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I was like, I didn't feel like I was like, what's going on? Like, I need the juicy details. But I just kind of, I was like, oh, I should know this. Mm-hmm. Like, I should understand the situation in front of me. I convinced myself not to. And I am glad that I did, because also I don't need to have that information. Like, it's really not something that I should, like, be sticking my nose in.
Yeah.
But then also, like, the police officers don't want to entertain me. They don't want to, like, they're busy. They're working. Someone was hurt. Something happened. They don't want to deal with this, like, drunk 20-year-old just being like, so what's going on down here?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, they don't. But then I think, the counterpoint to that would be, like, well, it's, like, your community. You should kind of, like, I don't know, like, the cops should be kind of telling you what's going on.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like, the sense that you don't know what's going on is almost kind of weird, too, right? That, like, something's happening in your community and you just don't know what it is.
And I asked my roommates the next day, I was like, did you guys see what happened? And they were like, oh, no, I had no idea. And which I also find, like, kind of just jarring, because I assumed, like, I didn't see them for a full day, so I asked them yesterday. But I had assumed that they'd at least, like, woken up and heard it, or, like, seen, like, been woken up by the lights or, like, by the sirens. But they just slept through all of it.
Yeah.
Like, if I hadn't been, if I hadn't gone out that night, like, I just would never have known that this happened. Which, like, does feel weird because it was in such close proximity to, like, where I live. And, like I feel like I should kind of know. But then also I live on an alley, which, like, it doesn't feel like I live in a community. It just, like...
Right. Because you're renting, too, I guess, sometimes can make you feel like that. I remember I had, when I was in Montreal over the break, I had one day where I was, it was really late at night and it was super cold. I was in Montreal. It was, like, super snowy. And what happens in Montreal when it's super snowy is you get, like, this weird, like, amber light from all the street lights on the snow. And then just going home, and I passed, like, quite close to my house, like, a bunch of cop cars, similar thing, and a snow plow. And, like, just didn't know what it was. Talked to the cab driver a little bit about it, and we didn't really know what it was. And then the next morning, I did find out what it was. And it was, like, it was pretty bad. It was, like, about as bad as I thought it would be, which is, like, somebody got hit by the snow plow and died. And that was a weird sense, even though I didn't, like, watch it. Like, even if you don't watch it happen, the sense that even that there's, like, ambulances and there's, like, a trace of it still is kind of, like, alarming in a weird way.
Yeah.
I don't know. But then there is, going back to what you're saying about, like, wanting an explanation, or that maybe, like, it shouldn't have an explanation, you know? That, like, you shouldn't be nosy.
Well, I'm kind of, I don't want to say jealous, but, like, the thing that you saw, like, you could figure out what happened. Like, you did kind of have an initial idea, like, the like it was the worst case scenario, but it was a scenario. I have, like, no idea.
Right.
Like I don't want to, like, my first assumption was, like, oh, someone OD'd, but, like, that doesn't really make sense in the neighborhood that I live in. And also, like, why? Like, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then the guy was getting handcuffed, so I was like, oh, maybe he
So somebody's culpable.
Yeah, but that guy also, like, was too drunk, and he seemed like they were kind of friends almost.
Okay, right.
Like, it so many factors just kept confusing me more. And I couldn't even, like, I still haven't found out, like, what is going to happen. Like, what did happen.
Yeah. I mean, in that sense, like, a lot of the times I find the afterlife of those kind of events is often with, like, how you're actually going to think about that alley now, you know, and, like, that view. Did you feel that sort of, or?
Well, no, I woke up today and it was so beautiful out. Like, it.
Yeah.
Like, what I think is, like, the most, like, not concerning, but the thing that makes me least comfortable is that, like, it totally disappeared. Like,
right.
It was totally gone. Like, any trace of it. And then also, like, waking up today and it was like, oh, like a beautiful, like, it kind of, like I mentioned before the show, I thought it was like a weekend. Like, I was like, oh, a beautiful sunny day to kind of like live my life in.
Yeah.
But then when I did, I looked out the window just above my bed this morning and I was like, oh yeah, someone died there. Like,
yeah.
Oh, cool. I managed to like walk past it this morning without really registering it. I'm just like realizing now. Mm-hmm. I kind of just like have my routine where I just don't really encounter that parking lot specifically, but yeah, probably every time I like come from the opposite direction now, I'm gonna be like, oh yeah, that happened.
Mm-hmm. And then when you feel like you might be the only witness too, there's this kind of thing where you're like, maybe you should remember it or have something for it. I don't know.
Oh yeah,
it's kind of a weird, it's a really weird thing about living in a city, I guess. Sometimes you just see really horrible stuff
and you're just like, oh, okay, like
that
happened.
Yeah, well, I guess you're right, it is like a really beautiful day outside today and that's really nice.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
I get to wear my sunglasses, which like I always feel very powerful in.
Yeah, Dora looks cool as heck in sunglasses.
if you ever see me, you know that's me, that cool as heck girl.
That's Dora. Cool. Dora, thanks so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Dora is the new media coordinator at the station. She's on the student exec. She's also head of the Film Society.
Yeah.
Does the Film Sock have anything coming up that you can plug?
Oh, heck yeah. A few things. We have a couple trivia nights this month.
Cool.
Next one is next Thursday, so not the 2nd, the 9th, and it's Lord of the Rings themed.
Great.
I love Lord of the Rings. I want to write the questions because I feel like this is the only one that I'm like really qualified to write questions for, but I also really want to answer the questions at the same time.
So you don't want to be the one writing them.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. That's like a fun dilemma that I have. And then we also just decided that we're going to do Space Jam as our beer garden this year.
It's the first movie I ever saw as a child. I was 3 years old.
Oh.
Second to Space Jam.
That's so funny. My first movie was Toy Story 2.
Oh, great.
Yeah. My Sweet. Mom like loves that story. We went to the theater and we loved it.
Did you go with your twin?
Yeah.
Sweet.
Oh,
good.
Duh.
Duh. Okay.
How dare
cool.
You.
Next up, we have an interview from UBC V-Day with Elena Mabrito. This is a lost tape from 24 Hours of Student Power. But yeah, thank you again, Dora. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. Here is interview with UBC V-Day. Studio with Elena Mabrito, who is from UBC V-Day. Elena, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming in. I really appreciate it. Why don't you tell me just to start a little bit about UBC V-Day and what it's all about?
Yeah, so V-Day is a global movement to raise awareness of violence against women and girls. UBC has been participating in the V-Day movement for many years. I'm not sure of the exact start date. V-Day movements kind of around the world are comprised of different parts. So one component is the production of the vagina monologues. And it's other times there are fundraisers and like other live performances that are done. Another part of our personal V-Day campaign here at UBC is we always sell vulva chocolates. So they're chocolate shaped like vulvas that one can buy in the nest in February and January to raise money.
Great. And so the main event is sort of like this performance, mm-hmm. which is a play, am I right, that was written in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to be acting in it.
Yes.
What exactly is this play? Give me a little synopsis of it.
Yeah. So The Vagina Monologues was written by Eve Ensler, like you said, in 1996. It's basically an exploration of like womanhood, women's bodies, women's sexuality, women's health. So it explores like different facets of women's life from childbirth to getting your first period to sex to pubic hair to kind of everything. It's the monologue I'm doing this year is a monologue about a sex worker who only does sex work with women. And it's kind of a celebration of women's sexuality and women being okay and, like, being okay with enjoying sexual pleasure and with that being normalized, like women's enjoyment of sexual pleasure. So it's a monologue I'm passionate about. It's a good one. Yeah, but it's a cool, I'd say, overall, the representation in it is quite good, in the play is quite good, with, like, different demographics of people. There is some conflation of, like, women and vaginas. So in the piece, like, women are said to have vaginas. And, of course, as we know, like, there are plenty of people who identify as women who don't have vaginas and plenty of people with vaginas who don't identify as women. So that is a bit that is pretty problematic about the play and something that we talk about in our talk back after, as well as with a couple other issues that are raised in the piece, just because it was written 21 years ago, right? So there is stuff that is outdated.
Cool, yeah. So you have the performance, which is maybe, what, like, an hour and a half, something like that, and then you have this talk back, which is I guess another hour or so, and then or longer, I'm not sure. And then what kind of goes on in that talk back? Tell me a little bit about what that looks like.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. So the piece is, yeah, about an hour and a half, and then the talk back can be anywhere from, like, half an hour to an hour. It kind of just depends on the audience and, like, how many questions they have and stuff. Yeah, so during the talk back, we really like to draw attention to things in the script that we don't necessarily agree with. So the piece was written in 1996, so there are a lot of things that are kind of outdated, and that we don't agree with. So, like I said, one of those things is the idea that to be a woman you need to have a vagina, which is not true and not something that we agree with at all. As a collective, we believe that gender identity and sex are totally separate and, like, not correlated in any way. So that's something that we talk about during the talk back. We also talk about, so one of the pieces in the play is called They Beat the Girl Out of My Boy, and it talks about the experiences of trans women. And one of the issues with that is it really focuses on transitioning, and the person who's speaking starts out as a man. They have I guess at the beginning of the play, they have a female gender identity, but their sex is male. And then over the course of the play, they transition to, they keep their female gender identity, but by the end of the play, their sex, they're anatomically female. And the play kind of reproduces the idea that to actually have a valid female gender identity, one must be anatomically female, which, again, is not something we agree with. So that's a piece where there's a lot of contention around it, where that is a valid experience, like having a gender identity and a sex that corresponds. That's absolutely valid, and a lot of people do choose to go through that process and have a sex that corresponds with their gender identity, but a lot of people also don't, and, like, that expression is also valid to keep the body you were born with, and to have a gender identity that doesn't correspond, quote unquote, with the sex you were born with. So, yeah, that's something we talk about. Yeah, I think those are kind of
you articulated that really well. What is the sort of dynamic in this talk back? If it's immediately after the performance, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden this fourth wall is sort of broken, and is it the performers that are coming on and leading the performance, or how does it work logistically?
Oh yeah, so it's just the cast. There's about 18 of us, I'd say. Because there's, like, 18 monologues, roughly, and then the director. And it's a mix of, like, the audience asking us questions. We've all been to, like, awkward talkbacks. They suck. So we always have a couple questions in our back pocket just in case the audience isn't too chatty. But in terms of audience response, the responses are generally pretty positive. People generally have kind of follow-up questions about the pieces. We do usually a piece called A Memory, A Monologue, A Rant, and A Prayer, which looks specifically at violence against women. So the Vagina Monologues is kind of more holistic in it, that it looks at women's experience holistically, and it's pretty funny for the most part and kind of tongue-in-cheek, whereas A Memory, A Monologue, A Rant, and a prayer is quite heavy. And so the responses to that one were often a little bit more contentious. I know we had one comment last year was why is this still relevant? Like, we're living in the safest time ever in history. Like, statistically, you look at the statistics and this is the safest time ever to be alive. Like, your risk of dying prematurely is so low. And kind of our response to that was, but this is still a problem. Like, shouldn't that make us more, you know, more ready to take up this cause? Like, because we are living in, you know, the statistically safest period in history, the fact that women are still sexually assaulted, people are still sexually assaulted, privy to sexual violence, like, this is something that, you know, we need to draw attention mm-hmm. to.
Yeah, more of an opportune time even to start talking about
it,
even though it has aged. With MERP as well, there's this sense where even though they've aged a little bit, there's still this sort of utility. I mean, even utility feels like a harsh kind of cold way of approaching it, but that they're worth salvaging in some way, mm-hmm. that they're worth continuing to have and to put on yearly. And how is that something you kind of reconcile as a performer to thinking about this and thinking about this kind of, you know, even if you feel not 100% comfortable with everything in the script, mm-hmm. how do you, as a performer, kind of see that salvaging process?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's a really good question. And that is something that is talked about a lot when people talk about the vagina monologues. You know, should we do this piece? There are so many problems with it. And I think for me personally, as an actor, I make the choice to do this piece, but I do this piece because there is that talk back afterwards. And I know that, the contentious issues in the piece, the things that I don't agree with can be brought up. So I think, yes, like, this is a good piece, but here are the things that I don't agree with that are said in this piece. So I definitely think the talk back is super imperative. I think for me, one of the most valuable parts of the performance is the community of people who you get to meet in doing this, the majority of whom are women, but of course non-binary people would always be welcome to join in the group as well. And that's just a really powerful experience. I don't think there are too many places where one gets to be in a group that is just women and non-binary people. And beyond that, I don't think, like, you, as a person living in this society, we are often in a place where you are in a group of only women and non-binary people, but also in a place where you are free to talk about your sexuality and about, you know, your experience as a woman and more importantly, your intersectional experience as a woman, right? And how, you know, the other elements of your identity, your sexuality, your ethnicity and things play into your experience of being a woman. So I think having that opportunity and having the ability to connect with women who are aware of these issues and aware of the ways in which different elements of identity connect and affect each other is just really powerful. Like, it shows you you're not alone, and it shows you that there are other women who are of your age who believe in these things, which is really cool. And I guess, and not of your age too, this year we have a really diverse cast age-wise. Our youngest is, I think, 18 or 19, and then our oldest performer is 48. So it's it's a wide age range this year.
And you guys also do some workshops and some talks with it. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that and kind of this, like, the performance is something that's sort of unfolding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So V-Day, I mean, I think any rehearsal process, like, the process is more important than the performance, but I'd say for V-Day, the process is just such an integral part of the V-Day movement. So we bring in workshops and speakers, which is really cool. Let's see. So this year so far we always bring in people from like Access and Diversity and groups on campus that do work with equity. And so they come in and kind of talk to us about just kind of a general overview of terminology so that people are using, like, correct terminology when they're talking about social justice issues and issues of identity, because that's a really important place to start. We have to know what the proper terminology is before we can start having these conversations. We also always bring in med students from UBC to come give, like, a little talk on sexual and reproductive health, which before I started going to these workshops, I was like, this is dumb. I'm, like, an adult. Like, I don't need this. I've, like, gone to sex ed. No, these workshops are fantastic. Like, at the one this year, they, like, showed us what it looks like when you get a pap smear. Like, that's awesome. I didn't know that. So it just, and I always leave those workshops being like, I think it's ridiculous that we don't learn this stuff. Like, yeah. I'm 21 and I don't know what's in there.
Yeah.
Like, it could be anything. So yeah, so that's really cool. Yeah. Some of them are more artistic, We had a group come in last year who fights back against street harassment. So yeah, they're like, it's like a cool variety.
That's pretty
of
rad.
Things. Yeah.
What is it for you as a performer? I mean, I think when we have these questions of intersectional identities and when they're really coming out like this and really, you know, in the space of negotiation with something like UBC V-Day, what is it like for you as a performer who has to go in, and especially with a monologue form, mm-hmm. has to go in and really embody a kind of subjectivity that maybe you're not familiar with? I mean, mm-hmm. This isn't your first year doing this. You've done other monologues from this, you know, same piece before. What is that like? How do you think about that? And how do you reconcile with that, these ideas of, like, maybe claiming certain subjectivities?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And that's something that I think about a lot and struggle with in all the work that I do. Do I, based on, like, you know, the collection of my identities that I carry with me in the world, do I have the right to tell this story? Do I have the ability to tell this story? And yeah, I mean, that's something I try to be hyper conscious of. I think in this piece, most of the monologues, I feel like I would feel comfortable doing, in the sense that, I can identify with the protagonist. But yeah, I mean, so the one I'm doing this year is I'm a sex worker who only works with women. And that's not something that I have experienced, or that's not a profession that I have experienced. So I think, yeah, like, really important to do research. But no, I mean, I'd say, like, anytime you're on stage, it's just being respectful of the people's experiences that you're portraying, and knowing, like, when it's okay to, I guess, like, I think of it, like, do you have the right to play this role? Or is this someone's experience? Is this someone who has been marginalized in a way that you have not experienced? And then if you have not experienced that specific form of marginalization, is it appropriate for you to step into their shoes and portray that role? And I would say no.
Do you see the experience of playing these roles as a sort of collateral damage to the experience of putting on the play?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the fact that you have to go up and maybe speak, or at least speak as if you were somebody else, is that a downside, or is that something that you see as important for maybe activist practice?
Mm. No, I think that's a great question. I mean, I'd say, like, it's kind of whenever you do a theater performance, like, that is kind of what acting is you're agreeing to go on stage and to be someone else. And I think a big part of being an actor is respecting that lived subjective experience. Like, you're never, whenever you play a character in any of the shows that I've ever done, it's never been identical to my experience. There are elements that have absolutely been identical to my experience, but as a whole, you know, I've never fully matched the character. And I think something really important about being an actor is respecting the lived experiences of your character that you yourself have not experienced. I think specifically in a piece like this, where you are talking about, you know, sensitive topics like domestic violence and things like that, it's super, super important to be really respectful of the lived experiences. And I think that's something else that we do in the talk pack is draw attention to the lived experiences of these characters and acknowledge that, you know, some of us do not have these same lived experiences. I think as a director, as the directors for the pieces in the various years that it's been produced here, I think they do try to match actors with characters who have, characters with actors who have that lived experience. Like I said, going back to that idea of, I personally believe in theater that the actors who play people who are marginalized in certain ways should have been marginalized in those ways in real life. I think that is the appropriate way to show respect for the character's subjective lived experience. And I think that's definitely something that our director pays attention to as well.
Yeah, there's this whole kind of, like, ethics to performance in a weird way.
No, there totally is, 100%. And different people have different philosophies on it. I mean, that's just my own personal
absolutely.
Belief system. But
Where do you where do you see the Vagina Monologues going in future years? Because this is, you know, it's been going at UBC for a few years now. Mm-hmm. What is there to look forward to?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I'd say, so something we've been talking about for the past couple years is actually doing our own Vagina Monologues, because Eve Ensler's Vagina Monologues is 21 years old, and like we've talked about, there are like elements of people's experiences that aren't brought up in it, and so it would be cool to do kind of like a 2017 V-Day with, creating a series of monologues that talk about our own experience, what it's like to be women or non-binary people in, you know, the early 21st century. So I think that Eve Ensler's Vagina Monologues is a fantastic base, and I am so grateful for her work, but I think there's a lot of work to be done in making conversations around womanhood, women's bodies, non-binary bodies more accessible and more inclusive, and I think that's something that we aim to do.
How can people get involved? Yeah. How can they go see it?
So the show runs February 8th through 11th. It runs in the Nest Performance Space. Tickets can be purchased online at Brown Paper Tickets. We are also in the Nest selling tickets from now until February 8th. You can also purchase a vulva chocolate if you come to buy a ticket. They're delicious. They're milk and dark.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Elena Mabrito is an actor in UBC V-Day. Thank you so much for listening.
Get out to Hidden City Records on February 10th and celebrate the release of Being, the full-length debut from Vancouver art rock band Nothingness. The album is available now through Big Smoke Records and is accompanied by a three-colored silk screen poster in collaboration with visual artist Patrick Cruz. Tickets are $10 at the door with support from Spruce Trap and Moondle. Head over to www.bigsmokevancouver.com for more information.
Hey, this is Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Josh. I'm here in the studio today with Evan Morrison Glabick, who is an English honors student at UBC. It's for the segment called Tell Me About Your Paper. This is my favorite segment of the show. It's about academia. So Evan, tell me a little bit. I have in my hand here your thesis, which you have just defended, your undergraduate thesis. Tell me all about it. How was the defense?
Yeah, the defense was amazing. It was with Dr. Judy Siegel and Dr. Ian Hill, who are UBC English Department's sort of resident rhetoric experts. I really enjoyed the defense. It was just the three of us sitting in a room kind of chatting. They had really insightful questions that forced me to answer in ways that I wasn't expecting, mm-hmm. kind of elaborate in ways I wasn't expecting. And yeah, I enjoyed it very much.
You didn't feel too much like you were being attacked?
No, then. not at all. I mean, both of those profs are so kind and really wanted to sort of see me succeed in, mm-hmm. in every way. I mean, I can imagine when you get to PhD that it gets a bit more antagonistic.
When you're having like people you don't know maybe coming in specifically to pick at it a little bit.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
How long was it? Was it like, did you find it like grueling or was it?
Mm-mm. It's an hour.
Great.
In 15 minutes, you get to open up the floor, kind of warm things up by talking about why you chose the topic mm-hmm. and what you learned, what was unexpected, mm-hmm. where you might go in the future and that type of thing.
Cool. Well, that's a really good place to start. Why did you choose the topic?
I chose this topic.
Well, maybe first off, what is the topic?
Right. Topic is the rhetoric of anti-aging. So in this particular paper, I'm looking at product descriptions for products from a company called New Skin, which is based out of Utah, Provo, Utah. So two things were going on, I guess, when I chose the topic. One, I had this long-standing interest in kind of more like sci-fi grounded idea of immortality, appearance, alteration, that type of thing. And the other strain was that my mom got involved with New Skin. So she was a kind of distributor for this company that describes itself as a multi-level marketing company, which, you know, some people say is a pyramid scheme. Mm-hmm. And so I was around all this stuff, all these products, all this ideology. Rhetoric was kind of missing, like, as a way to understand what was happening. And I can't really explain how it happened. I was talking to Dr. Lorraine Weir about doing an honors thesis, and all of a sudden it just popped into my head that I wanted to do something with anti-aging. And then she said, you know, Judy Seagull, of course, and then Judy's A Virtuoso in Rhetoric. So that's where it went.
So the paper is titled New Skin for the Old Ceremony, A Case Study of Rhetoric and Anti-Aging Product Descriptions. Tell me a little bit about, for listeners, what is rhetoric? What is the study of rhetoric? What does that mean?
Okay, so the basic idea is that you're looking at how one person or a group of people are persuading another person or another group of people to do something. So Aristotle said it was the available means of persuasion. So that's what I'm looking at in the product descriptions. I'm also looking at the idea of who the audience is. Rhetoric looks at what constitutes an audience, the character of the rhetor, and the sort of emotions that might be being appealed to. And then there's a whole breakdown of the different kind of inventional and stylistic techniques that are being used to persuade people to do something, to make some action, or to believe something.
So what particularly were you looking at? What were you looking at in terms of the style kind of characteristics of this rhetoric?
Well, in particular in this paper, I'm looking at three elements from rhetoric. So one is enthymeme. That's an inventional or argumentational element. Another is definition, which is one of Aristotle's original topics. And the other is systrophe or systrophe, which is a stylistic technique. They all kind of come together, and I'll explain what they mean in a second. Mm-hmm. They all kind of come together to convince a consumer or distributor of that the body is, first of all, material, physical, and that materiality and physicality is the same thing as the self. So enthymeme is basically it's a deductive form of reasoning, so it's a syllogism from which some premises are omitted. So the kind of classic example is, if I were to say to you, Socrates is a man, like, therefore he's mortal, then I'd be kind of omitting the premise that all men are mortal, right?
So that's okay. So you're making kind of like a jump.
Making a jump, and I'm asking you implicitly to fill in the gaps, and that's what enthymeme does. And systrophe is really interesting, too. It's a style, it's a circumlocutory style, whereby you offer a lot of definitions of something without actually saying what it is. So the kind of locus classicus for that is that Hamlet, what a work is man? I can't quite remember how it goes. But, you know, he lists all these things that is man. And I'm sorry for these, like, super...
Listen, bringing some class to the show.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's just all my examples. All these locus classicuses have men in them, but yeah. Okay, so systrophe, you're giving a lot of definitions without giving a general definition, or you're giving a lot of descriptions of a thing without a general definition. So this is something that's happening in these product descriptions in terms of concepts like vitality, age, youth, this sort of thing. You're getting a lot of descriptions of what these things are without a real definition of what they are.
Right, so... You know, these are you're saying, these are particularly like masculine examples. And the product itself was a product that was targeted at women, was it targeted at male consumers? What was kind of the target audience? And also, what about the jump from, because, yeah, these examples and this like theory of rhetoric, it's very old. It traditionally has these like classical applications. Mm-hmm. How is it studying something like a product, like a modern product? Maybe just, yeah, the first one first. Like, what? Tell me a bit about the product.
About the product. Okay, yeah. So, well, I did want to say something about the target, you know, the target audience. That's not something I touched too much on in the paper because it's difficult to determine, like, who from these product descriptions. And that's kind of part of it. Mm-hmm. There's a universalization of the idea of age, of the idea of fearing age, and the sort of crux of the paper is the biomedicalization of age. So the idea, not only, you know, the medicalization of age, not only that age is something that falls within the jurisdiction of medicine and is a problem that can be approached medically, but that that medical problem is then approached through the biological sciences. And in the biomedicalization of aging, the big thrust is that things should be transformed. So rather than controlled from the outside in medicalization, things could be transformed from the inside out. So, and this is the idea that gets applied to age and aging. is that we can transform ourselves from the inside out into younger, more vital mm-hmm. people. And in terms of audience, one of the things that the Project Descriptions does is that it universalizes this desire to transform ourselves. So companies like Nu Skin have listened really carefully to critiques, like feminist critiques of the anti-aging industry. That doesn't mean that they're not sexist, these product descriptions, but it just means that they've taken pains to appeal to a really broad audience.
With this kind of sci-fi androgyny almost, right? This sort of like universalizing beige, you know, gray off-tones kind of idea.
Well, part of this thesis is taking up some of the post-humanist ideas of aging. So, you know, you say sci-fi and this kind of brave new world element that's often invoked as a kind of a fearful future or present. So in post-humanist aging, the idea is that, you know, the body is like a prosthetic or prosthesis that we all learn to manipulate. It's the, you know, Catherine Hale says that it's the original prosthesis we all learn to manipulate. That's one of the kind of core cultural constructions or cultural technological constructions that the product descriptions are being asking people to swallow. And that's one of the things that gets omitted in some of the enthymematic arguments that the product descriptions make. They're interesting to see, too. I mean, you say that they're kind of gray, and, like, you're right, they're white. They're very much whitewashed. Like, if you go to the websites, it's a lot of white, a lot of things floating, a lot of kind of, like, calm reflections of the product in some kind of, like, marble pharmacist tabletop or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, for listeners who may be, again, not familiar with rhetoric studies, how they might be wondering, you know, how is this – you know, a lot of classical thought, you know, it goes into rhetoric and it's still like held up quite high in the study of rhetoric. How does it go from these, you know, old Greek and Latin terms to studying, what's that jump like to studying something modern and something so new? What are the challenges there?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's broadly that something that I've learned from kind of from Judy and Ian that the field of rhetoric and rhetorical analysis has struggled with itself. You know, there have been like turns during the 20th century away from Aristotle. Burke is a good example, Kenneth Burke, who, you know, wanted to look at rhetoric as identification. So, you know, how rhetor can get an audience to identify with her or get audience members to identify with themselves, you know, these sorts of ideas. There's no simple kind of way of, I guess, of you definitely can't exclude Aristotle. I mean, you sort of his book, The Art of Rhetoric, is just such a good classification of all these different topics. And a topic is sort of, you know, something that you can draw on to structure your argument. So an example might be a comparison. It's like a very basic topic. I mean, these are super basic things that we do all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Burke also said that we're helplessly rhetorical, human beings, that is. In more recent iterations of rhetoric, people are doing cool and curious things with objects. So rhetoric of objects, kind of talking like an object-oriented ontology. Rhetorical analysis, non-human rhetors, for instance, place and space as rhetorical elements. So these are kind of, people are adding. So they're all kind of adding onto and reorganizing Aristotelian rhetorical terms. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about the process of writing this itself. What was that like? What was that like sitting down and, you know, and getting to it? Tell me a little bit about what that looked like.
It looked like me, like, sitting in my bed worrying about my lower back a lot, typing on my laptop. I didn't use a lot of, like, I used three texts, I guess. I used the Kenneth Burke Rhetoric of Motives, which I didn't end up citing in the paper at all. I used The Art of Rhetoric by Aristotle, which I cited a ton. And then this book called Rhetorical Hermeneutics, which is all about the rhetoric of science. That I also didn't cite at all. So those kind of like, I mean, I had three books, but it was mainly these papers from all sorts of different disciplines that I just kind of found, you know, just keyword searching. That was the cool thing, I think, about writing this paper is that it took me so far out of my milieu.
Mm-hmm.
into sociology and anthropology and gerontology and science, you know, which I don't have a science background, but kind of trying to familiarize myself with the scientific claims that New Skin is drawing on. So that was super fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the basic, getting down that basic science is really, I have trouble with that too. And then it's so important and you feel just so lost a lot of the times when you're trying to get that stuff down and you know it's important and you know it's not just the rhetoric, right? That there's stuff going on there and that that's important to it too. Yeah. It's not just an empty shell of rhetoric, right?
Yeah.
So you're writing it over this course of last semester. Over what a couple of months, and were you doing it in? I'm curious because this is like quite a big project. Like, were you doing it in like sitting down and a couple hours a week, or were you doing that thing where you're trying to write every day? I know that's kind of like an academic suggestion or guideline, is you try to write something every day. What was kind of your philosophy going into the actual writing process?
I think it was born of necessity. I would just, any sort of time I had, I would just turn to the thesis. It was like a conditioning. It conditioned me, I think, the thesis did. And then there would be also, you know, when I had deadlines and I'd be writing all night. So I didn't have so much of a philosophy going into it. It was kind of heuristic. I just sort of, I just did my best to get as much done as possible. I was telling you before we went on air about kind of being surprised at how much work it took and how many labor hours really went into it. And Judy's really rigorous about precision and composition, conceptual precision, and that was initially really tough. But then once we kind of got going together, like, it started to flow better. And as you were saying, like, the process by which you eventually just know what needs to be done, like, kind of takes care of itself at a certain point, and you. You start to see the paper in a totally different light, kind of the mechanics of it and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how many times do you go back and forth with your advisor?
Like a good dozen.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
It must have been so, like, just so important for that paper, and that must have been so, like, generative too.
It was. Judy was saying yesterday during the defense that we'd spoken in bubbles, and that's kind of what it really was like, you know. And now when most of the correspondence that you have with your professor is through email, it's just like, I didn't see her for months, you know, but we were having this intense correspondence through email and exchanging in large portions of text. So I was curious.
So the other question they asked you with this, you know, introductory kind of thing when you're defending it was, what are you hoping to do with this? What are you hoping to go on and do with this?
Yeah, that's something they asked me yesterday too. And I don't have plans for grad school. So I wanted to write this thesis, I think in part to give a theoretical, get a theoretical framework for a novel that I want to write, a sci-fi novel.
Cool.
Yeah, it sounds kind of weird, but...
No, that seems like good research.
Yeah, it worked because it made me more sensitive to the issues of aging, you know, what categories are involved in our thinking about aging, what kind of hegemonic sort of assumptions we make about age.
Mm-hmm.
This is important.
Cool. Evan, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Josh. Thanks for asking me.
That was Evan. He is an English honors student here at UBC. Up next, I'm gonna fade you guys out, I guess, with Dee Tiffany. The song is Far Out. Thanks for listening so much to Textbook here on CITR 101.9 FM. ¶¶